leading to glory, but she will never unreservedly take any. Painting, sculpture, and literature are disciplines requiring strict training and demanding solitary work. Many women try such work but quickly abandon it if they are not driven by a positive desire to create, and many of those who persevere never do more than play at working. Marie Bashkirtseff, so avid for glory, spent hours in front of her easel, but she loved herself too much to seriously love to paint. She admits it herself after years of bitterness. "Yes, I don't take the trouble to paint. I watched myself today. I cheat." When a woman succeeds, like Madame de Stael or Madame de Noailles, in building a body of work, it is because she is not exclusively absorbed by self-worship. But one of the burdens that weighs on many women writers is a self-indulgence that hurts their sincerity, limits, and diminishes them. Many women imbued with a feeling of superiority, however, are not able to show it to the world. Their ambition will thus be to use a man whom they convince of their worth as their means of intervention. They do not aim for specific values through free projects. They want to attach ready-made values to their egos. They will thus turn, by becoming muses, inspiration, and stimulation to those who hold influence and glory in the hope of being identified with them. A striking example is Mabel Dodge in her relations with Lawrence. "I wanted to seduce his spirit so that I could make him carry out certain things. It was his soul I needed for my purpose, his soul, his will, his creative imagination, and his lighted vision. The only way to obtain the ascendancy over these essential tools was by way of the blood. I was always trying to get things done. I didn't often even try to do anything myself. I seemed to want to use all my power upon delegates to carry out the work. This way, perhaps a compensation for that desolate and barren feeling of having nothing to do, I achieved a sense of fruitfulness and activity vicariously." Note, Lujan, Lorenzo and Taos, translation. And further on, "I wanted Lawrence to understand things for me, to take my experience, my material, my Taos, and to formulate it all into a magnificent creation." In a similar way, Georgette Leblanc wanted to be food and flame for Maeterlinck, but she also wanted to see her name inscribed in the poet's book. This is not, here, a question of ambitious women having chosen personal aims and using men to reach them, as did Madame de Stael and the Princess des Ursins, but rather of women animated by a wholly subjective desire for importance, with no objective aim, trying to appropriate for themselves the transcendence of another. They do not always succeed, far from it, but they are skillful in hiding their failure and in persuading themselves that they are endowed with irresistible seduction. Knowing they are lovable, desirable, and admirable, they feel certain of being loved, desired, and admired. Belize is wholly narcissistic. Even the innocent Brett, devoted to Lawrence, invents for herself a little personage she endows with weighty seduction. "I raise my eyes and see that you are looking at me with your mischievous fawn-like air, a provocative gleam in your eyes, Pan. I stare back at you with a solemn and dignified air until the gleam goes out of your face." These illusions can give rise to real derangement. Clérambault had good reason to consider erotomania a kind of professional derangement. To feel like a woman is to feel like a desirable object, to believe oneself desired and loved. It is significant that 9 out of 10 patients with illusions of being loved are women. They are clearly seeking in their imaginary lover the apotheosis of their narcissism. They want him to be endowed with unconditional distinction, priest, doctor, lawyer, superior man, and the unquestionable truth his behavior reveals is that his ideal mistress is superior to all other women, that she possesses irresistible and sovereign virtues. Erotomania can be part of various psychoses, but its content is always the same. The subject is illuminated and glorified by the love of an admirable man who was suddenly fascinated by her charms, though she expected nothing from him, and displays his feelings in a circuitous but imperious way. This relation at times remains ideal and at other times assumes a sexual form, but what characterizes it essentially is that the powerful and glorious demigod loves more than he is loved, and he displays his passion in bizarre and ambiguous behavior. Among the great number of cases reported by psychiatrists, here is a typical one, adapted from Ferdiere. Note, l'erotomanie, erotomania. It concerns a 48-year-old woman, Marie-Yvonne, who makes the following confession. This is about Monsieur Achille, Esquire, former deputy and undersecretary of state, member of the bar and the Conseil de l'Ordre. I have known him since May 12, 1920. The evening before, I tried to meet him at the courts. From afar, I had noticed his strong stature, but I did not know who he was. It sent chills up my spine. Yes, there is an affair of feeling between us, a reciprocal feeling. Our eyes, our gazes met. From the moment I saw him, I had a liking for him. It is the same for him. In any case, he declared his feeling first. It was early in 1922. He received me in his home, always alone. One day he even sent his son out. One day he got up and came toward me, carrying on with his conversation. I understood right away that it was a sentimental surge. His words made me understand. By various kindnesses, he made me understand we had reciprocal feelings. Another time, once again in his office, he approached me saying, "It is you. It is you alone and no one else, madame. You understand clearly." I was so taken aback that I did not know what to answer. I simply said, "Thank you, sir." Then another time he accompanied me from his office to the street. He even got rid of a man who was with him. He gave him 20 sous in the staircase and told him, "Leave me, my boy. You see I am with madame." All of that was to accompany me and be alone with me. He always shook my hands tightly. During his first court pleading, he made a comment to let me know he was a bachelor. He sent a singer to my courtyard to demonstrate his love to me. He watched my windows. I could sing you his romance. He had a town band march by my door. I was foolish. I should have responded to his advances. I gave Monsieur Achille the cold shoulder. He thus thought I was rejecting him, and he took action. He should have spoken out openly. He took revenge on me. Monsieur Achille thought that I had feelings for B, and he was jealous. He made me suffer by putting a magic spell on my photograph. At least that is what I discovered this year through studies in books and dictionaries. He worked enough on this photo. It all comes from that. This delusion easily changes, in fact, into a persecution complex, and this process is found even in normal cases. The narcissist cannot accept that others are not passionately interested in her. If she has the clear proof she is not adored, she immediately supposes she is hated. She attributes all criticism to jealousy or spite. Her failures are the result of dark machinations, and thus they confirm her in the idea of her importance. She easily slips into megalomania, or the opposite, persecution delirium, as center of her universe, and aware of no other universe except her own, she becomes the absolute center of the world. But narcissist drama plays itself out at the expense of real life. An imaginary personage solicits the admiration of an imaginary public. A woman tormented by her ego loses all hold on the concrete world. She does not care about establishing any real relationship with others. Madame de Stael would not declaim Phaedra so wholeheartedly if she had foreseen the mockeries her admirers noted that night in their notebooks. But the narcissist refuses to accept she can be seen other than as she shows herself. This is what explains why, so busy contemplating herself, she totally fails to judge herself, and she falls so easily into ridiculousness. She no longer listens, she talks, and when she talks, she recites her lines. Marie Bashkirtseff writes, "It amuses me. I don't speak with him. I act, and, feeling I am in front of a receptive audience, I am excellent at childlike and fanciful intonations and attitudes." She looks at herself too much to see anything. She understands in others only what she recognizes about them. Whatever she cannot assimilate to her own case, to her own story, remains foreign to her. She likes to expand her experiences. She wants to experience the headiness and torments of being in love, the pure joys of motherhood, friendship, solitude, tears, and laughter. But because she can never give herself, her sentiments and emotions are fabricated. Isadora Duncan undoubtedly cried real tears on the death of her children. But when she cast their ashes into the sea with a great theatrical gesture, she was merely being an actress, and one cannot read this passage where she evokes her sorrow in my life without embarrassment. I feel the warmth of my own body. I look down on my bare legs, stretching them out, the softness of my breasts, my arms that are never still, but continually waving about in soft undulations. And I realize that for 12 years I have been weary. This breast has harbored a never-ending ache. These hands before me have been marked with sorrow. And when I am alone, these eyes are seldom dry. In the worship of self, the adolescent girl can muster the courage to face the disturbing future. But it is a stage she must go beyond quickly. If not, the future closes up. The woman in love who encloses her lover in the couple's imminence dooms him to death with herself. The narcissist, alienating herself in her imaginary double, destroys herself. Her memories become fixed, her behavior stereotyped. She dwells on the same words, repeats gestures that have lost all meaning. This is what gives the impression of poverty found in secret diaries or feminine autobiographies. So occupied in flattering herself, the woman who does nothing becomes nothing and flatters a nothing. Her misfortune is that, in spite of all her bad faith, she is aware of this nothingness. There cannot be a real relationship between an individual and his double, because this double does not exist. The woman narcissist suffers a radical failure. She cannot grasp herself as a totality, as plenitude. She cannot maintain the illusion of being in itself, for itself. Her solitude, like that of every human being, is felt as contingence and abandonment. And this is why, unless there is a conversion, she is condemned to hide relentlessly from herself in crowds, noise, and others. It would be a grave error to believe that in choosing herself as the supreme end, she escapes dependence. On the contrary, she dooms herself to the most severe slavery. She does not make the most of her freedom. She makes herself an endangered object in the world and in foreign consciousnesses. Not only are her body and face vulnerable flesh, worn by time, but from a practical point of view, it is a costly enterprise to adorn the idol, to put her on a pedestal, to erect a temple to her. We have seen that to preserve her form in immortal marble, Marie Bashkirtseff had to consent to marry for money. Masculine fortunes paid for the gold, incense, and myrrh that Isadora Duncan and Cécile Sorel laid at the foot of their thrones. As it is man who incarnates destiny for woman, women usually gauge their success by the number and quality of men subjected to their power. But reciprocity comes into play again here. The praying mantis, attempting to make the male her instrument, does not free herself from him like this, because to catch him, she must please him. The American woman, trying to be an idol, makes herself the slave of her admirers, does not dress, live, or breathe other than through the man and for him. In fact, the narcissist is as dependent as the hetaira. If she escapes an individual man's domination, it is by accepting the tyranny of public opinion. This link that rivets her to others does not imply reciprocity. If she sought recognition by others' freedom while also recognizing that freedom as an end through activity, she would cease to be narcissistic. The paradox of her attitude is that she demands to be valued by a world to which she denies all value, since she alone counts in her own eyes. Outside approbation is an inhuman, mysterious, and capricious force that must be tapped magically. In spite of her superficial arrogance, the narcissistic woman knows she is threatened, It is why she is uneasy, susceptible, irritable, and constantly suspicious. Her vanity is never satisfied. The older she grows, the more anxiously she seeks praise and success, the more she suspects plots around her. Lost and obsessed, she sinks into the darkness of bad faith and often ends up by building a paranoid delirium around herself. The words, "Whosoever shall save his life will lose it," apply specifically to her. Chapter 12. The Woman in Love. The word love has not at all the same meaning for both sexes, and this is a source of the grave misunderstandings that separate them. Byron rightly said that love is merely an occupation in the life of the man, while it is life itself for the woman. The same idea is expressed by Nietzsche in The Gay Science. The same word love, he says, means in fact two different things for the man and for the woman. What woman means by love is clear enough. Total devotion, not mere surrender, with soul and body, without any consideration or reserve. In this absence of conditions, her love is a faith. Woman has no other faith. Man, when he loves a woman, wants precisely this love from her and is thus himself as far as can be from the presupposition of feminine love. Supposing, however, that there should also be men to whom the desire for total devotion is not alien, well, then they simply are not men. Men might be passionate lovers at certain moments of their existence, but there is not one who could be defined as a man in love. In their most violent passions, they never abandon themselves completely. Even if they fall on their knees before their mistresses, they still wish to possess them, annex them. At the heart of their lives, they remain sovereign subjects. The woman they love is merely one value among others. They want to integrate her into their existence, not submerge their entire existence in her. By contrast, love for the woman is a total abdication for the benefit of a master. Cécile Sauvage writes, "When the woman loves, she must forget her own personality. This is a law of nature. A woman does not exist without a master. Without a master, she is a scattered bouquet." In reality, this has nothing to do with a law of nature. It is the difference in their situations that is reflected in the conceptions man and woman have of love. The individual who is a subject, who is himself, endeavors to extend his grasp on the world if he has the generous inclination for transcendence. He is ambitious. He acts. But an inessential being cannot discover the absolute in the heart of his subjectivity. A being doomed to immanence could not realize himself in his acts. Closed off in the sphere of the relative, destined for the male from her earliest childhood, used to seeing him as a sovereign, with whom equality is not permitted, the woman who has not suppressed her claim to be human will dream of surpassing her being toward one of those superior beings, of becoming one, of fusing with the sovereign subject. There is no other way out for her than losing herself body and soul in the one designated to her as the absolute, as the essential. Since she is, in any case, condemned to dependence, she would rather serve a god than obey tyrants, parents, husband, protector. She chooses to want her enslavement so ardently that it will seem to her to be the expression of her freedom. She will try to overcome her situation as inessential object by radically assuming it. Through her flesh, her feelings, and her behavior, she will exalt as sovereign the one she loves. She will posit him as value and supreme reality. She will efface herself before him. Love becomes a religion for her. We have seen that the adolescent girl at first wishes to identify with males. Once she renounces this, she then seeks to participate in their virility by being loved by one of them. It is not the individuality of one man or another that seduces her. She is in love with man in general. "And you, the men I will love, how I await you," writes Irène Rebouillotti. "How I rejoice in soon knowing you, you especially, the first one." Of course, the man must belong to the same class and the same race as her own. The privilege of sex works only within this framework. For him to be a demigod, he must obviously be a human being first. For the daughter of a colonial officer, the native is not a man. If the young girl gives herself to an inferior, she is trying to degrade herself because she does not think she is worthy of love. Normally, she looks for the man who represents male superiority. She is rapidly led to discover that many individuals of the chosen sex are sadly contingent and mundane. But first, she is favorably disposed toward them. They have less to prove their value than to keep from grossly disavowing it. This explains many often lamentable errors. The naive young girl is taken in by virility. According to the circumstances, male worth will appear to her as physical force, elegance, wealth, culture, intelligence, authority, social situation, or a military uniform. But what she always hopes for is that her lover will be the summation of the essence of man. Familiarity often is enough to destroy his prestige. It breaks down with the first kiss, or in everyday contact, or on the wedding night. Love at a distance is nonetheless merely a fantasy, not a real experience. When it is carnally consummated, desire for love becomes passionate love. Inversely, love can arise from making love, the sexually dominated woman exalting the man who first seemed insignificant to her. But it often happens that the woman is unable to transform any of the men she knows into a god. Love holds less place in feminine life than is often believed. Husband, children, home, pleasures, social life, vanity, sexuality, and career are far more important. Almost all women have dreamed of the great love. They have had imitations. They have come close to it. It has come to them in incomplete, bruised, trifling, imperfect, and false forms, but very few have really dedicated their existence to it. The great women lovers are often those who did not waste their emotions on juvenile crushes. They first accepted the traditional feminine destiny, husband, home, children, or they lived in difficult solitude, or they counted on some venture that more or less failed. When they glimpsed the chance to save their disappointing life by dedicating it to an elite being, they desperately give themselves up to this hope. Mademoiselle Aïssé, Juliette Drouet, and Madame d'Agoult were nearly 30 when they began their love lives. Julie de Lespinasse was close to 40. No goal was available to them. They were unprepared to undertake any venture that seemed worthwhile to them. Love was their only way out. Even if they are allowed independence, this road is still the one that seems the most attractive to most women. It is agonizing to take responsibility for one's life endeavor. The adolescent boy too readily turns to older women, seeking a guide, a tutor, a mother in them. But his education, customs, and the inner constraints he faces prevent him from definitively accepting the easy solution of abdication. He views such loves merely as a phase. It is man's luck, in adulthood as in childhood, to be made to take the most arduous roads but the surest ones. Woman's misfortune is that she is surrounded by nearly irresistible temptations. Everything incites her to take the easy way out. Instead of being encouraged to fight on her own account, she is told that she can let herself get by, and she will reach enchanted paradises. When she realizes she was fooled by a mirage, it is too late. She has been worn out in this adventure. Psychoanalysts like to claim that the woman seeks her father's image in her lover, but it is because he is man, not father, that he dazzles the child, and every man shares this magic. The woman wishes not to reincarnate one individual in another, but to bring back to life a situation, one she knew as a little girl, sheltered by adults. She was an integral part of her family home life. She felt the peace of quasi-passivity. Love will bring her mother as well as her father back to her, and her childhood as well. What she wishes is to find a roof over her head, walls that hide her from her abandonment within the world, laws that protect her from her freedom. This childish dream haunts many feminine loves. The woman is happy when her lover calls her, "My little girl, my dear child." Men know the words well. you look like a little girl, are among the words that most surely touch the hearts of women. We have seen how many of them have suffered becoming adults. Many persist in acting like a child, and indefinitely prolonging their childhood in their attitude and dress. To become a child again in the arms of a man brings them great satisfaction. It is the theme of this popular tune. I feel so small in your arms, so small, oh my love. A theme tirelessly repeated in lovers' conversations and correspondence. Baby, my baby, murmurs the lover, and the woman calls herself little one, your little one. Irene Ruelio-T writes, when then will he come, the one who will be able to dominate me? And thinking she had met him, I love feeling you a man and better than me. A psychasthenic woman studied by Janet illustrates this attitude in the most striking way. As far back as I can recall, all the foolish acts or all the good deeds I have done stem from the same cause, an aspiration to the perfect and ideal love where I can give myself entirely, confide all my being to another being, God, man, or woman, so superior to me that I would no longer think of leading my life or watching over myself. To find someone who would love me enough to take the trouble to make me live, someone whom I would blindly and confidently obey, sure that he would keep me from all failure and would put me on the right track, very gently and with much love, toward perfection. How I envy the ideal love of Mary Magdalene and Jesus. To be the ardent disciple of an adored and worthy master, to live and die for one's idol, believe in him without any possible shadow of doubt, to hold at last the final victory of the angel over the beast, to be held in his enveloping arms, so small, so pressed in his protection, and so much his that I no longer exist. Note, Pierre Janet, Obsessions and Psychasthenia. Many examples have already proven to us that this dream of annihilation is in fact an avid will to be. In all religions, the adoration of God is part of the devotee's desire for his own salvation. By giving herself up entirely to the idol, the woman hopes he will give her possession both of herself and of the universe contained in him. In most cases, it is first the justification, the exaltation of her ego, she asks of her lover. Many women do not abandon themselves to love unless they are loved in return, and the love they are shown is sometimes enough to make them fall in love. The young girl has dreamed of herself as seen through the man's eyes. It is in man's eyes that the woman believes she has at last found herself. Cécile Sauvage writes, walking beside you, moving my tiny little feet that you loved, feeling them so slender in their high felt-topped shoes, made me love all the love you surrounded them with. The slightest movements of my hands and my muff, of my arms, of my face, the inflections of my voice, filled me with happiness. Note, translated by Beverly B. Brahek, translation. The woman feels endowed with a sure and high value. At last, she has the right to cherish herself through the love she inspires. She is exhilarated at finding a witness in her lover. This is what Colette's Vagabond admits. I must confess that in allowing this man to return tomorrow, I was giving way to my desire to keep, not an admirer, not a friend, but an eager spectator of my life and my person. One has to get terribly old, said Margot to me one day, before one can give up the vanity of living in the presence of someone else. Note, Colette, The Vagabond, translation. In one of her letters to Middleton Murray, Catherine Mansfield recounts that she has just bought a ravishing mauve corset. She quickly adds, what a pity there is no one to see it. Nothing is more discouraging than to feel that one is the flower, the perfume, the treasure that no desire seeks. What good is an asset that does not enrich me and that no one wants as a gift? Love is the revealer that shows up in positive and clear traits, the dull negative image as empty as a black print. The woman's face, the curves of her body, her childhood memories, her dried tears, her dresses, her habits, her universe, everything she is, everything that belongs to her, escapes contingence and becomes necessary. She is a marvelous gift at the foot of her God's altar. Before his hands were laid gently on her shoulders, before his eyes took their fill of hers, she had been a plain, dull woman in a plain, dull world. He kissed her, and she stood in the rose light of immortality. Note, Mary Webb, The House in Dormer Forest. Thus, men endowed with social prestige and good at flattering feminine vanity will arouse passion even if they have no physical charm. Because of their lofty situation, they incarnate law and truth. Their consciousness discloses an uncontested reality. The woman they praise feels transformed into a priceless treasure. According to Isadora Duncan, D'Annunzio's success came from this. When D'Annunzio loves a woman, he lifts her spirit from this earth to the divine regions where Beatrice moves and shines. In turn, he transforms each woman to a part of the divine essence. He carries her aloft until she believes herself really with Beatrice. He flung over each favorite in turn a shining veil. She rose above the heads of ordinary mortals and walked surrounded by a strange radiance. But when the caprice of the poet ended, this veil vanished. The radiance was eclipsed, and the woman turned again to common clay. To hear oneself praised with that magic peculiar to D'Annunzio is, I imagine, something like the experience of Eve when she heard the voice of the serpent in paradise. D'Annunzio can make any woman feel that she is the center of the universe. Note, Isadora Duncan, My Life. Only in love can woman harmoniously reconcile her eroticism and her narcissism. We have already seen an opposition between these two systems that makes the woman's adaptation to her sexual destiny very difficult. Making herself carnal object and prey contradicts her self-adoration. It seems to her that lovemaking disfigures and defiles her body or degrades her soul. Some women, therefore, choose frigidity, thinking they can thus preserve the integrity of their ego. Others dissociate animal sensuality and lofty sentiments. A very characteristic case is Mrs. D.S.'s, reported by Stekel, and which I have already cited concerning marriage. Frigid and married to a respected man, after his death there came into her life a young man. He, too, was an artist and a wonderful musician. She became his mistress. Her love was and is to this day so great that she feels happy only in his presence. Her whole life is wrapped in her Lothar. In spite of her great love for him, she has remained cool in his arms. Another man, too, crossed her path. He was a forester, a powerful, rough individual who, on finding himself alone with her one day, took possession of her without saying a word. She was so consternated that she didn't object. In his embrace, she experienced the keenest orgasm. In his arms, she states, I have regained my health for the past months. It is like a wild intoxication, but followed by an indescribable disgust when I think of my Lothar. Paul I hate, Lothar I love. Nevertheless, Paul is the one who gratifies me. Everything about Lothar holds me to him, but it seems I must act like a harlot in order to feel. As a lady, I can never respond. She refuses to marry Paul, but continues to sleep with him. In those moments, she becomes like a person transformed, and the raw words which escape her lips, she would never be guilty of using on any other occasion. Stekel adds that, for many women, the descent into animality is the condition for orgasm. They see an abasement in physical love impossible to reconcile with feelings of esteem and affection. For others, by contrast, it is by the man's esteem, tenderness, and admiration that this abasement can be abolished. They only consent to give themselves to a man if they believe they are deeply loved by him. A woman has to be very cynical, indifferent, or proud to consider physical relations as an exchange of pleasures, in which each partner equally gets something out of it. The man revolts as much as, and perhaps more than, the woman against anyone who wants to exploit him sexually. Note, refer to, among others, Lady Chatterley's Lover. Through Mellors, Lawrence expresses his horror of women who make him a tool of pleasure. But she is the one who generally has the impression that her partner is using her as an instrument. Only exalted admiration can make up for the humiliation of an act she considers a defeat. We have seen that the love act requires a woman's profound alienation. She is awash in the indolence of passivity. Eyes closed, anonymous, lost, she feels transported by waves, caught up in torment, buried in the night, night of flesh, of the womb, of the tomb. Reduced to nothing, she reaches the whole, herself effaced. But when the man separates himself from her, she finds herself thrown back to earth, on a bed, in the light. She has a name and a face again. She is a conquered person, a prey, an object. This is when love becomes necessary to her. Just as after being weaned, the child seeks the reassuring gaze of his parents, it is in the eyes of the lover who contemplates her that the woman whose flesh has been painfully detached has to feel reunited with the whole. She is rarely completely satisfied. Even if she experienced the relief of pleasure, she is not entirely freed from the carnal spell. Her arousal becomes feeling. In providing her with sensuality, the man attaches her to him and does not liberate her. He, though, no longer feels desire for her. She only forgives him for this momentary indifference if he has vowed timeless and absolute feeling to her. Then the imminence of the instant is transcended. The burning memories are no longer a regret, but a treasure. As it dies down, the sensuality becomes hope and promise. Sexual pleasure is justified. The woman can gloriously assume her sexuality because she transcends it. Arousal, pleasure, and desire are no longer a state, but a gift. Her body is no longer an object. It is a song, a flame. Thus, she can abandon herself passionately to the magic of eroticism. Night becomes light. The woman in love can open her eyes, look at the man who loves her and whose gaze glorifies her. Through him, nothingness becomes plenitude of being, and being is transfigured into value. She no longer sinks into a sea of darkness. She is transported on wings, exalted to the sky. Abandon becomes holy ecstasy. When she receives the loved man, the woman is inhabited, visited like the virgin by the Holy Spirit, like the believer by the wafer. This explains the obscene analogy between holy hymns and ribald songs. It is not that mystical love always has a sexual side, but the sexuality of the woman in love takes on a mystical tone. My God, my beloved, my master. The same words spill from the lips of the kneeling saint and the woman in love lying on the bed. The saint offers her flesh to Christ's arrows. She holds out her hands to receive the stigmata. She implores the burning of divine love. The woman in love also offers and waits. Darts, stinger, and arrows are embodied in the male sex. In both of them, there is the same dream, the infantile, mystical love dream. To exist sovereignly by effacing oneself within the other. It has sometimes been claimed that this desire for effacement leads to masochism. Note, it is, among others, H. Deutsch's theory in Psychology of Women. But as I have noted concerning eroticism, one can only speak of masochism if I try to cause myself to be fascinated by my objectivity for others. Note, refer to Sartre, Being and Nothingness. That is, if the consciousness of the subject turns back to the ego to grasp it in its humiliated situation. But the woman in love is not only a narcissist alienated in herself, she also experiences a passionate desire to go beyond her own limits and become infinite, thanks to the intervention of another who has access to infinite reality. She abandons herself first to love to save herself. But the paradox of idolatrous love is that in order to save herself, she ends up totally disavowing herself. her feeling takes on a mystical dimension. She no longer asks God to admire her or approve her. She wants to melt into him, forget herself in his arms. "I would have liked to be a love saint," writes Madame d'Agou. "I envied the martyr in such moments of exaltation and ascetic furor." What comes through in these words is the desire for a radical destruction of the self, abolishing the frontiers that separate her from her beloved. It is not masochism, but a dream of ecstatic union. The same dream inspires these words of Georgette Leblanc. "At that time, had I been asked what I most wanted in the world, without any hesitation, I would have said, to be food and flame for his spirit." To achieve this union, the woman first wants to serve. She will feel necessary in responding to her lover's demands. She will be integrated into his existence. She will be a part of his value. She will be justified. Even mystics like to believe, according to Angelus Silesius, that God needs man. Otherwise, the gift they make of themselves would be in vain. The more demands the man makes, the more fulfilled the woman feels. Although the seclusion Hugo imposed on Juliette Drouet weighed on the young woman, one feels she is happy to obey him. Staying seated close to the fire is doing something for the master's happiness. She passionately tries to be positively useful to him. She prepares special dishes for him, creates a home for him. "Your little nest for two," she said sweetly. She takes care of his clothes. She writes to him, "I want you to stain and tear all your clothes as much as possible, and that I alone should mend and clean them, and nobody else." For him, she reads newspapers, cuts out articles, organizes letters and notes, copies manuscripts. She is upset when the poet entrusts part of this work to his daughter, Leopoldine. Similar characteristics are found in all women in love. If need be, she tyrannizes herself in the lover's name. Everything she is, everything she has, every second of her life must be devoted to him and thus find their raison d'être. She does not want to possess anything except in him. What would make her unhappy is that he demand nothing of her, and so an attentive lover invents demands. She first sought in love a confirmation of what she was, her past, her personage, but she also commits her future. To justify it, she destines it to the one who possesses all values. She thus gives up her transcendence. She subordinates it to that of the essential other whose vassal and slave she makes herself. It is to find herself, to save herself, that she began by losing herself in him. The fact is that little by little, she loses herself. All reality is in the other. Love that was originally defined as a narcissistic apotheosis is accomplished in the bitter joys of a devotion that often leads to self-mutilation. At the outset of a consuming passion, the woman becomes prettier, more elegant than before. "When Adele does my hair, I look at my forehead because you love it," writes Madame d'Agou. This face, this body, this room, this me, she has found a raison d'être for them. She cherishes them through the mediation of this beloved man who loves her. But later, she gives up all coquetry. If the lover so desires, she changes this face that had once been more precious than love itself. She loses interest in it. She makes what she is and what she has the fief of her lord. What he disdains, she disavows. She would like to devote to him each beat of her heart, each drop of blood, the marrow of her bones. This is what a dream of martyrdom expresses, to exaggerate the gift of self to the point of torture, of death, to be the ground the beloved treads on, to be nothing but that which responds to his call. She vigorously eliminates everything the beloved finds useless. If this gift she makes of self is totally accepted, there is no masochism. Few traces of it are seen in Juliette Drouet. In her excessive adoration, she sometimes knelt before the poet's portrait and asked him to excuse the mistakes she might have committed. She did not angrily turn against herself, but the slide from generous enthusiasm to masochistic rage is easy. The woman in love who finds herself before her lover in the same situation as the child before his parents, also recovers the feeling of guilt she experienced around them. She does not choose to revolt against him as long as she loves him. She revolts against herself. If he loves her less than she desires, if she fails to interest him, to make him happy, to be sufficient to him, all her narcissism turns into disgust, humiliation, and self-hatred that push her to self-punishment. During a longer or shorter crisis, sometimes for a whole life, she will be a willing victim. She will go out of her way to harm this self that has not been able to satisfy the lover. Then her attitude is specifically masochistic. But cases where the woman in love seeks her own suffering so as to get revenge on herself, and those where she seeks confirmation of the man's freedom and power, must not be confused. It is a commonplace, and seems to be a reality, that the prostitute is proud to be beaten by her man. But it is not the idea of her battered and enslaved person that exalts her. It is the strength, authority, and sovereignty of the male on whom she depends. She also likes to see him mistreat another male. She often pushes him into dangerous competitions. She wants her master to hold the values recognized in the milieu to which she belongs. The woman who gladly submits to masculine caprices also admires the proof of a sovereign freedom in the tyranny that is wielded over her. One must be careful to note that if for some reason the lover's prestige is ruined, his blows and demands become odious to her. They are only worth something if they manifest the beloved's divinity. In that case, it is intoxicatingly joyous to feel oneself the prey of a foreign freedom. For any existent, the most surprising adventure is to find oneself sustained by the diverse and imperious will of another. One is tired of inhabiting the same skin all the time. Blind obedience is the only chance of radical change that a human being might experience. So here is the woman slave, queen, flower, doe, stained glass window, doormat, servant, courtesan, muse, companion, mother, sister, or child, depending on the lover's fleeting dreams, the lover's imperious orders. She complies with delight with these metamorphoses, as long as she does not recognize that she still has the same taste of submission on her lips. In love, as well as in eroticism, it appears that masochism is one of the paths the unsatisfied woman takes, disappointed by the other and by herself. But this is not the natural slope of a happy resignation. Masochism perpetuates the presence of the self as a hurt, fallen figure. Love aims at the forgetting of self in favor of the essential subject. The supreme aim of human love, like mystical love, is identification with the loved one. The measure of values and the truth of the world are in his own consciousness. That is why serving him is still not enough. The woman tries to see with his eyes. She reads the books he reads, prefers the paintings and music he prefers. She is only interested in the landscapes she sees with him, in the ideas that come from him. She adopts his friends, his enemies, and his opinions. When she questions herself, she endeavors to hear the answer he gives. She wants the air he has already breathed in her lungs. The fruits and flowers she has not received from his hands have neither fragrance nor taste. Even her hodological space is upset. The center of the world is no longer where she is, but where the beloved is. All roads lead from and lead to his house. She uses his words. She repeats his gestures, adopts his manias and tics. "I am Heathcliff," says Catherine in Wuthering Heights. This is the cry of all women in love. She is another incarnation of the beloved, his reflection, his double. She is he. She lets her own world founder in contingence. She lives in his universe. The supreme happiness of the woman in love is to be recognized by the beloved as part of him. When he says, "we," she is associated and identified with him. She shares his prestige and reigns with him over the rest of the world. She does not tire of saying, even if it is excessive, this delicious "we." Necessary to a being who is absolute necessity, who projects himself in the world toward necessary goals, and who reconstitutes the world as necessity, the woman in love experiences in her resignation the magnificent possession of the Absolute. It is this certitude that gives her such great joys. She feels exalted at the right hand of the God. What does it matter that she is always in second place, as long as it is her place, forever, in a marvelously ordered world? As long as she loves, as she is loved and necessary for the beloved, she feels completely justified. She savors peace and happiness. Such was perhaps Mademoiselle Aïssé's lot at Knight Daïdi's side before religious scruples troubled her soul, of Juliette Drouet's in Hugo's shadow. But this glorious felicity is seldom stable. No man is God. The relations the mystic has with the divine absence depend on his fervor alone, but the deified man, who is not God, is present. That is where the torments of the woman in love stem from. Her most ordinary destiny can be summarized in Julie de Lespinasse's famous words, "At every instant of my life, my friend, I love you, I suffer, and I await you." Of course, for men too, suffering is linked to love, but their heartbreaks either do not last long or are not all-consuming. Benjamin Constant wanted to die for Juliette Récamier. In 1 year, he was cured. Stendhal missed Mathilde for years, but it was a regret that enriched his life more than destroying it. In accepting herself as the inessential and as total dependence, the woman creates a hell for herself. All women in love see themselves in Andersen's Little Mermaid, who, having exchanged her fishtail for a woman's legs out of love, walked on needles and burning coals. It is not true that the beloved man is unconditionally necessary and that she is not necessary to him. It is not up to him to justify the woman who worships him, and he does not let himself be possessed by her. An authentic love should take on the other's contingents, that is, his lacks, limitations, and originary gratuitousness. It would claim to be not a salvation, but an interhuman relation. Idolatrous love confers an absolute value on the loved one. This is the first lie strikingly apparent to all outsiders. "He doesn't deserve so much love," people whisper around the woman in love. Posterity smiles pityingly when evoking the pale figure of Count Guibert. It is a heart-rending disappointment for the woman to discover her idol's weaknesses and mediocrity. Colette, in The Vagabond, and Mes Apprentissages, My Apprenticeships, often alludes to this bitter agony. This delusion is even crueler than the child's at seeing paternal prestige crumble, because the woman herself chose the one to whom she made a gift of her whole being. Even if the chosen one is worthy of the deepest attachment, his truth is earthbound. It is not he whom the woman kneeling before a supreme being loves. She is duped by that spirit of seriousness which refuses to put values in parentheses, not recognizing that they stem from human existence. Her bad faith erects barriers between her and the one she worships. She flatters him. She bows down before him. But she is not a friend for him, since she does not realize he is in danger in the world, that his projects and finalities are as fragile as he himself is. Considering him the law and truth, she misunderstands his freedom, which is hesitation and anguish. This refusal to apply a human measure to the lover explains many feminine paradoxes. The woman demands a favor from the lover. He grants it. He is generous, rich, magnificent. He is royal. He is divine. If he refuses, he is suddenly stingy, mean, and cruel. He is a devilish being or bestial. One might be tempted to counter. If a yes is understood as a superb extravagance, why should one be surprised by a no? If the no manifests such an abject egotism, why admire the yes so much? Between the superhuman and the inhuman, is there not room for the human? A fallen god, then, is not a man. It is an imposture. The lover has no alternative other than to prove he is really the king one adulates, or to denounce himself as a usurper. When he is no longer worshipped, he has to be trampled on. In the name of this halo with which the woman in love adorns her beloved, she forbids him all weakness. She is disappointed and irritated, if he does not conform to this image she put in his place. If he is tired, confused, if he is hungry or thirsty, when he should not be, if he makes a mistake, if he contradicts himself, she decrees he is not himself, and she reproaches him for this. Likewise, she will go so far as to reproach him for all the initiatives she does not appreciate. She judges her judge, and in order for him to deserve to remain her master, she refuses him his freedom. Her adoration is sometimes better served by his absence than his presence. There are women, as we have seen, who devote themselves to dead or inaccessible heroes so that they never have to compare them with flesh and blood beings. The latter inevitably fail to live up to their dreams. Hence the disillusioned sayings, "You shouldn't believe in Prince Charming. Men are just poor things." They would not seem like dwarfs if they were not required to be giants. This is one of the curses weighing on the passionate woman. Her generosity is immediately converted into demands. Being alienated in another, she also wants to salvage herself. She has to annex this other who holds her being. She gives herself to him entirely, but he has to be totally available to receive this gift honorably. She dedicates all her moments to him. He has to be present at every moment. She only wants to live through him, but she wants to live. He has to devote himself to making her live. Madame Dagoux writes to Liszt, "I love you sometimes stupidly, and at such times, I do not understand that I could not, would not be able to, and should not be for you the same absorbing thought as you are for me." She tries to curtail her spontaneous wish to be everything for him. There is the same appeal in Mademoiselle de l'Espinasse's complaint. "My God, if you only knew what the days are like, what life is like without the interest and pleasure of seeing you. My friend, dissipation, occupation, and movement satisfy you. And I, my happiness is you. It is only you. I would not want to live if I could not see you and love you every minute of my life." At first, the woman in love is delighted to satisfy her lover's desire. Then, like the legendary fireman who, out of love for his job, lights fires everywhere, she works at awakening this desire so as to have to satisfy it. If she does not succeed, she feels humiliated, useless to such an extent that the lover will feign passion he does not feel. In making herself a slave, she has found the surest means of subjugating him. This is another lie of love that many men, Lawrence, Montholon, have resentfully denounced. He takes himself for a gift when he is a tyranny. In Adolphe, Benjamin Constant fiercely painted the chains the overly generous passion of a woman entwines around the man. She did not count her sacrifices because she was busy making me accept them, he says cruelly about Eleanor. Acceptance is thus a commitment that ties the lover up without his even having the benefit of appearing to be the one who gives. The woman demands that he graciously welcome the loads she burdens him with. And her tyranny is insatiable. The man in love is authoritarian, but when he has obtained what he wanted, he is satisfied. But there are no limits to the demanding devotion of the woman. A lover who has confidence in his mistress shows no displeasure at her absences or if she is occupied when away from him. Sure that she belongs to him, he prefers to possess a freedom more than a thing. By contrast, the absence of the lover is always torture for the woman. He is a gaze, a judge. As soon as he looks at something other than her, he frustrates her. Everything he sees, he steals from her. Far from him, she is dispossessed both of herself and of the world. Even seated at her side, reading, writing, he abandons her. He betrays her. She hates his sleep. Baudelaire is touched by the sleeping woman. "Your beautiful eyes are weary, poor lover." Proust delights in watching Albertine sleep. Note that Albertine is an Albert does not change anything. Proust's attitude here is, in any case, the masculine attitude. Male jealousy is thus simply the desire for exclusive possession. The woman beloved, when sleep gives her back the disarming candor of childhood, belongs to no one. For the man, this certitude suffices. But the god, the master, must not abandon himself to the repose of imminence. It is with a hostile look that the woman contemplates this destroyed transcendence. She detests his animal inertia, this body that no longer exists for her but in itself, abandoned to a contingence whose ransom is her own contingence. Violette Le Duc forcefully expressed this feeling. I hate sleepers. I lean over them with bad intent. Their submission exasperates me. I hate their unconscious serenity, their false anesthesia, their studiously blind face, their reasonable drunkenness, their incompetent earnestness. I hovered. I waited for a long time for the pink bubble that would come out of my sleeper's mouth. I only wanted a bubble of presence from him. I didn't get it. I saw that his night eyelids were eyelids of death. I took refuge in his eyelids' gaiety when this man was impossible. Sleep is hard when it wants to be. He walked off with everything. I hate my sleeper who can create peace for himself with an unconsciousness that is alien to me. I hate his sweet forehead. He is deep down inside himself busy with his rest. He is recapitulating who knows what. We had left post-haste. We wanted to leave the earth by using our personality. We had taken off, climbed up, watched out, waited, hummed, arrived, whined, won, and lost together. It was a serious school for playing hooky. We had uncovered a new kind of nothingness. Now you're sleeping. Your effacement is not honest. If my sleeper moves, my hand touches, in spite of itself, the seed. It is the barn with 50 sacks of grain that is stifling, despotic. The scrotum of a sleeping man fell on my hand. I have the little bags of seed. I have in my hand the fields that will be plowed, the orchards that will be pruned, the force of the waters that will be transformed, the four boards that will be nailed, the tarpaulins that will be lifted. I have in my hand the fruits, flowers, and chosen animals. I have in my hand the lancet, the clippers, the probe, the revolver, the forceps, and all that does not fill my hand. The seed of the sleeping world is only the dangling extra of the soul's prolongation. You, when you sleep, I hate you. Note, je hais les dormeurs, I hate sleepers. The god must not sleep, or he becomes clay and flesh. He must not cease to be present, or his creature founders in nothingness. For woman, man's sleep is avarice and betrayal. At times, the lover wakes his mistress. It is to make love to her. She wakes him simply to keep him from sleeping, to keep him nearby, thinking only of her, there, closed up in the room, in the bed, in her arms. Like God in the tabernacle, this is what the woman desires. She is a jailer. And yet, she does not really consent to have the man be nothing else but her prisoner. Here is one of the painful paradoxes of love. Captive, the god sheds his divinity. The woman preserves her transcendence by handing it over to him, but he must bring it to the whole world. If two lovers disappear into the absolute of passion together, all freedom deteriorates into imminence. Only death can provide a solution. This is one of the meanings of the Tristan and Isolde myth. Two lovers who are exclusively destined for each other are already dead. They die of boredom. Marcel Arlan, in Terres étrangères, Foreign Lands, described the slow agony of a love that devours itself. The woman understands this danger. Except for cases of jealous frenzy, she herself demands that man be project and action. He has to accomplish exploits to remain a hero. The chevalier who embarks on new feats of prowess offends his lady, but she scorns him if he stays seated at her feet. This is the torture of impossible love. Woman wants to have man all to herself, but she demands that he go beyond all the givens he could possibly possess. One does not have a freedom. She wants to lock up here inexistent, who is, in Heidegger's words, a being from afar. She knows full well that this effort is futile. My friend, I love you as one should love, with excess, madness, rapture, and despair, writes Julie de l'Espinasse. Idolatrous love, if lucid, can only be hopeless. For the woman in love who asks her lover to be a hero, giant, demigod, demands not to be everything for him, whereas she can find happiness only if she contains him entirely within herself. Nietzsche says, a woman's passion, in its unconditional renunciation of rights of her own, presupposes precisely that there is no equal pathos, no equal will to renunciation, for if both partners felt impelled by love to renounce themselves, we should then get, I do not know what, perhaps an empty space? Woman wants to be taken. She wants someone who takes, who does not give himself or give himself away. On the contrary, he is supposed to become richer in himself. Woman gives herself away. Man acquires more. Note, The Gay Science. In any case, the woman will be able to find her joy in this enrichment she brings to her loved one. She is not all for him, but she will try to believe herself indispensable. There are no degrees in necessity. If he cannot get along without her, she considers herself the foundation of his precious existence, and she derives her own worth from that. Her joy is to serve him, but he must gratefully recognize this service. Giving becomes demand, according to the customary dialectic of devotion. Note, I have tried to show this in Pyrrhus et Cineas. And a woman of scrupulous mind asks herself, is it really me he needs? The man cherishes her, desires her with singular tenderness and desire, but would he not have just as singular feelings for another? Many women in love let themselves be deluded. They want to ignore the fact that the general is enveloped in the particular, and the man facilitates this illusion because he shares it at first. There is often in his desire a passion.